Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer in Patients with an EGFR Tumor Mutation. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program is a follow-up to a live CME activity we did during the ASCO meeting in Chicago in early June. I met with Dr. Jonathan Goldman from UCLA Health in Santa Monica, California, who was a faculty member for the live program, to review and comment on some of the concepts that came up during the meeting. To begin, Dr. Goldman discussed the transformation of care that's occurring in earlier stage disease, particularly related to the ongoing outcomes reported from the ADAURA trial.
The ADAURA trial really changed my practice of care and led to much happier discussions with patients with higher stage disease. We do push a little bit more for surgical resection in a stage three that maybe we would have done chemoradiation prior. The straightforward patients, the stage two and three, most of them are going to get chemotherapy. And I would use the same criteria I used before. If a patient's elderly, renal insufficiency, or let's say 75 plus and is not interested in chemotherapy, then I would do osimertinib alone. But most of those patients are getting chemotherapy for four cycles and then osimertinib. The stage 1Bs, I'm usually foregoing the chemotherapy and giving osimertinib. And that's perhaps the happiest discussion. Those patients are really excited about getting an oral drug and avoiding IV chemotherapy. The challenging ones, I think, are just below stage 1B. Those patients, many of them would like to get something, and the risk of recurrence is really problematic. In breast cancer, we would never accept that kind of recurrence risk. So we do have the ADAURA 2 trial that we're running for stage 1A2 and 1A3 against placebo, and that's a nice place for that to answer that question. Interestingly, breast cancer is a good comparison to think about it. The tolerability in the adjuvant setting is different than the metastatic setting. I think that was somewhat apparent running the trial and seeing the patients, but even those are somewhat more motivated patient than your average patient. I have had more people need to dose reduce in the adjuvant setting, and certainly a few that said, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm losing weight, or even not clearly for significant toxicity, just grade 1-2 toxicity, saying I don't want to continue. We've had to deal with more mucositis also, which almost never was reported in the metastatic setting. I wonder if maybe patients wanted to not complain, so we wouldn't lower the dose, that kind of thing.
That's really interesting observation or comment there. What are some of the key toxicity issues that you see in the adjuvant setting that become problematic over time?
It's the constitutional ones and mucositis, decreased appetite, and weight loss. And then I think secondary to that, some fatigue. There are a lot of these patients are in their 40s and 50s, still working, and are used to living a very full, complete life, working, some of them, very high achieving 50, 60 hour a week work days. And so they really notice that they've lost this weight, lost this energy. One thing I think is important to say is that lowering the dose from 80 to 40 milligrams probably retain most of the benefit. So in those patients, I'd make some adjustments, try some mouth rinses for the mucositis, but if that doesn't cut it, I feel pretty comfortable lowering the dose.
What do you see the role of nurses and nurse practitioners in this setting? There are a lot of situations in oncology where people, PARP inhibitors are in long-term maintenance with drugs that do have toxicity. And at your place, are the nurse practitioners and nurses important in that regard?
Yes, I have two nurse practitioners that work really closely with me, and they see most of the patients at some point. A lot of times they'll go in and then I'll come in afterwards. Questions like lowering the dose makes patients nervous, and so I think a lot of times they want to have that discussion with me. But managing the toxicity, I think, is a great place for nurses to be involved. We're really trying to use some of the patient communication tools like texting through the portal, that kind of thing. And it can be a little bit overwhelming on the physician side, but a great place for the nurse practitioners to say, try this mouth rinse. We'll send a dexamethasone mouth rinse to you, and then we'll see you in clinic next week and see how it's going.
So you mentioned breast cancer, and I'm glad you brought that up because I've brought something up about breast cancer to some lung investigators. I want to try bringing it up to you. Which, you know, in breast cancer in the adjuvant setting, they have this concept that, you know, you figure out what the hazard rate is, which a lot of times they do with high-risk patients, like with tamoxifen, for example, the original adjuvant trials. But then they take that hazard rate and they apply it down to the lower-risk patient, and they might not have data there, but they apply it. They see what the absolute benefit is. You know, maybe the patient only has a 20% risk. But they apply the hazard rate and they say, okay, it's going to be reduced, you know, from 20 to, you know, 18 or whatever it is. They look at the toxicity and help the patient decide whether they want to do that. And to me, that relates to a couple questions that you already commented. One was the ADORA 2 trial in the lower risk patients. And I'm happy that the trial is being done, but kind of I wonder, like, what do you expect to see? Do you expect to see the hazard, just what I just described? And would you be okay with people, or do you yourself, if the patient can't be on the trial, offer it?
I think those are great questions. If you look at ADORA and now LAURA, as the stage goes up or down, the hazard ratio is not exactly consistent. You know, you get a better benefit both numerically and by hazard ratio the higher your risk is. So there is probably a point where it doesn't translate into clear benefits. But I think it's very worthwhile having that kind of discussion with patients. And I think redeveloping an adjuvant online patient tool would be great. In my practice, I have followed the ADORA guidelines. So if it's 3.0 centimeters or less, I have not been giving osimertinib. And I could understand a question close to 3 centimeters. We have used, certainly a satellite nodule would increase the stage, and then we've given osimertinib. But I've tried to follow the data and figured that pretty soon we should have some results from ADORA 2.
Well, let me put it to you another way. My question is, for the typical patients that you see, if you said, would you be willing to try osimertinib, knowing that you can stop it if you have a problem with it, but the benefit's going to be, you know, 1 out of 20, do you think anybody or many people would want to do it?
I think we have to assume that many patients would want to do it. There's, you know, the ability to stop it if you have significant side effects is really important. The very low rate of serious irreversible side effects, you know, even pneumonitis that we worry about so much is generally quite reversible. So I do agree with you. I do agree with you, and it's easy to put yourself in the patient's shoes and understand that. You know, as you started the conversation with breast cancer concepts, their patients are taking drugs for a long time for a couple percentage benefit.
Another thing is, if you remember about the adjuvant online model that was really cool, was they also factored in competing non-cancer mortality. So when you get to 85 and 90, you started to see that even though the hazard rate was good, they were dying of other things. So really, that was pretty cool. But the other thing I wanted to just bring up about hazard rate that I thought was interesting is what you were saying about chemo. So, because I've always kind of questioned, you know, you all always go your survival benefit. Maybe the hazard rate's like 0.88 or something, right? Too great.
Not in today's world, right? Right.
Right. So, but my question is, if you're given osimertinib, you're going to knock out 80% of the recurrences. So the chemo is only really going to be relevant to the 20%. So it's even a lower number if you look at it that way.
Yeah. I think my concern facing the patient is that someone who's, you know, 45, 55, 60 has a really long time horizon that they're worried about. And The osimertinib, you know, clearly lowers systemic recurrence, CNS recurrence at a pretty low cost for, you know, 3-5 years. But there were some concerning factors that came out in some of the Kaplan-Meier curves of the CNS recurrence is starting to catch up with the placebo arm after 3 years. And I have seen a few patients that 6 or 12 months after osimertinib have recurrence. And so I think certainly in some cases, and it's hard to know what percentage, the osimertinib is delaying recurrence, not curing them. And the chemo, I think, has a potential role, a real, you know, you might use the word incremental, but a real improvement in overall survival that's quite durable.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you about is some of the newer data that's coming out, particularly the ctDNA data. If you remember, Roy in one of the videos was saying we're going to present, but we hadn't seen the data at that point. So they actually had cell-free DNA data or MRD analysis. Can you talk about what they saw there? And, you know, I kind of was thinking this is maybe going to be the future, but I don't know, you tell me.
I agree completely. I think it's easy to see that future coming in 3 to 5 years or so. I think the slides are a lot to go through, and I think really the presentation helped a lot. What you see is perhaps not that surprising, that if there's MRD at any point, the risk, you know, as measured by ctDNA, the risk of recurrence is significantly higher, and osimertinib is protective during the time that you're on it. I don't think it's clear at this point whether osimertinib can convert an MRD patient to a complete cure, meaning that they never recur, but it certainly delays recurrence in a really clinically meaningful way that I think will translate even in those patients to an OS benefit. It is possible to imagine that after 3 years of osimertinib, you monitor people for ctDNA, and if they become positive, you've identified a high-risk patient that you could restart osimertinib, you know, approximately 6 months earlier than you would have otherwise. And perhaps you can avoid some CT scans for those patients, and start them on osimertinib again, probably lifelong. And I think that is a real possibility. I do think when you think through, you know, why does ADAURA, even if it's not curing some patients, why does it lead to an OS benefit? It's because resistance develops more slowly in a really low volume of disease status. And so I think that probably starting earlier matters, and there are likely going to be some patients that are on this forever, lifelong, as we see in the LAURA trial.
So, you know, we were talking before about lower risk patients. What about the strategy like they have in colon cancer, where you just look post-op to see if they still have MRD positivity to decide whether to give it or not?
I think in the ADAURA analysis of MRD, it wasn't sensitive enough that, you know, there was high-risk patients that were going to recur that weren't picked up by ctDNA. And so I don't think the technology is there, but I think every couple of years it's clearly improved. So if that continues as you would expect, then I think that's possible. I think you could use it to, and maybe there's going to be other risk profiles, you know, gene expression profiles that help us classify early stage but high risk patients. Helena Yu has a trial that's addressing that question.
So, of course, one of the big issues that has come up because of the ADAURA trial is what do we do about all the other patients with targetable mutations? We've seen positive results, of course, in the ALK setting, but what about everything else? And I'm just curious right now, assuming you could access these drugs, in what situations would you use anything other than osimertinib if you could? I'm guessing that, you know, you're using ALK therapy, but what about everything else? BRAF, HER2, you know, ROS1,
So
theoretically, what would you like to do?
I think this is one of the most important questions in adjuvant lung cancer care is how do we extend the data and do we need a trial for each group? I am running a trial of selpercatinib for RET positive patients. There are a few interesting parts of the trial that are a little different than some of the ADAURA and alectinib data. We're allowing patients that had definitive radiation, so it's not only surgical patients. But one of the questions I got standing at my poster was, why do you need to do this trial? Don't we know ahead of time that it's going to be useful? And I do think that these drugs that have good tolerability for long-term use, excellent response rate, and good CNS penetration, those three criteria are likely predicting that these drugs will be very meaningful in the adjuvant setting. My best response to that question was right now patients are not getting tested for RET in the adjuvant setting. And getting this data out there will hopefully lead to NGS testing, I think, for stage 1B and above. Beyond that question, the more important question is, are we going to need to do a trial for each setting? I think there are the RAS drugs are not good enough yet, in my opinion. And I think it's questionable whether the ROS1 drugs are. I've heard other people say they think it's ready to go, but I think crizotinib is an okay ROS inhibitor, but not a fantastic one. And the better ones with the TRK inhibition are yes, better and worthwhile in the metastatic setting. But the TRK toxicities are real. Patients feel lightheaded. They become less active. A patient may start to, their world gets smaller because they're on these drugs. And so I think that's a downside that would be worth studying prospectively. I think with our best drugs, I think we have enough data to suggest that patients should be tested for these mutations and then acted on.
I can tell you that from the day the ADAURA trial was presented, when we've polled general medical oncologists and said, if you have a patient who is stage 2 or 3 with a RET alteration, if you could, would you give it? And like 60% of them would said yes.
So yeah.
Right for 2 years now. But of course, they may be a little bit ahead of the game, so to speak. But the same issue really relates to the other thing I want to ask you about, the big plenary presentation on the LARA trial. Again, no big surprise. I think a lot of people are already using osimertinib in that situation of locally advanced non-resectable. So I don't think there's going to be much question about whether to do it at this point. But again, the big question there is, okay, we've seen it here. What about in everything else?
Yeah.
So how about that?
I think, to bring alectinib into that setting, I think makes a lot of sense. I think that it is... it's a great drug and is well tolerated. And if it's not, you can dose reduce or stop if it's really not well tolerated. So I think for whatever reason, I haven't been faced with that question, but we certainly were faced with EGFR locally advanced after chemo radiation. And I was using osimertinib already. And so it's nice now to have the data to back it up and tell my patients, yes, we now know the hazard ratio is just getting better and better. It'll be nice to follow the OS curves because I think that's really what our patients want. But perhaps the most important thing from that was just seeing how bad the prognosis was for stage 3 EGFR mutated cancer. There were essentially no cures without osimertinib, and most patients, 80 to 90% are recurring in 2 to 3 years, so I think that getting them on osimertinib sooner rather than later and keeping them on long term is going to have a real OS benefit.
How long are you continuing the osimertinib?
It's not been a question long enough for me to get to 3 years yet, but This was really an amazing ASCO for lung cancer. I think one to remember.
Absolutely.
And Leisha Sequist, her discussion of this was really masterful. I think a lot of times, it's not always that a discussant changes the reception, but this one really did. I think there was questions of, why do you want to have these patients on osimertinib lifelong? Is it just, a financially driven preference? But seeing those curves and seeing the recurrence rate without osimertinib really, I think, is quite convincing that nearly all, if not possibly all, of these stage three patients are truly micrometastatic at that time. And being on osimertinib is going to be really important. And if we are thinking about extending out osimertinib beyond 3 years for anyone, this is the patient to do it. And I think patients are going to be able to tolerate it. As I said, I'd be comfortable lowering to 40 milligrams, but I do think we're going to see patients live a better and longer life with this.
So I also want to start to get into the issue of metastatic disease and particularly first-line therapy. And of course, in the meeting, we certainly got into the current alternatives in the first-line metastatic setting. Can you kind of go through that right now and how you make that decision right now and what you saw at ASCO that was helpful in educating you about how to approach this?
The EGFR therapy has gotten complex, and I think the great thing is that patients have these options to be more aggressive if they want to. Our main discussion to date with patients has been regarding the FLAURA2 option of osimertinib versus osimertinib with chemotherapy. And there, I think, again, trying to put yourself in the patient's shoes, there are some real benefits to adding the chemotherapy, and we can talk about which subgroups seem to particularly benefit. But the difference between taking a daily pill and seeing me every 3 months and hopefully having some real days where you don't think about having lung cancer versus coming in every 3 weeks, having, let's say, optimistically 3 to 5 days of not feeling great and maybe one or two of really not feeling well, every 3 weeks is a big difference in quality of life. I think that those kind of quality of life analyses will be important, but even those, I think, are probably not going to capture the effect on a patient. And so when we run through it, most of my patients are saying they want to just be on osimertinib. The chemotherapy, it was a positive trial. I think we participated. It was a positive trial and clearly positive. The brain metastasis patient unexpectedly really had a real benefit. It increased the rate of CNS complete response to almost 50%. And at a year, it doubles the rate that it remains in response to about two-thirds of patients are still in CNS response at a year if you give chemo. And so there, I can see that being beneficial. There are some patients that on osimertinib alone at 4 or 6 months are progressing. And if we can identify those up front and get them on chemo with osimertinib, I think there will be a real benefit to those patients. And now we have all these other questions with MARIPOSA. What is the role of amivantamab? I think that MARIPOSA as published with the IV amivantamab and the toxicities, they reported somewhat unexpected DVTs and PEs, and maybe that can be prevented with anticoagulation. But there you have the problem of coming in. I don't think it's actually that much better tolerated than chemotherapy when you come down to it. And the hazard ratio was a little bit better with the chemo combination, 0.6 instead of 0.7. So it is cross-trial comparison. But right now, as published with IV amivantamab, I think that the chemo combination probably is a preferred choice to me, at least. We'd have to get more experience. And then, maybe in the second line, that's where you bring in amivantamab.
Can you talk a little bit more about your experience with amivantamab, the infusion reaction, and other issues that come up? And also what you thought about the presentation at ASCO looking at sub-Q amivantamab?
So I think there are some great places for amivantamab. I think its use for EGFR exon 20 patients, really transformative. You know, not that rare, but not that rare. I certainly see it, you know, every couple months. And those patients previously had no targeted therapy, and it's an effective drug, both monotherapy and with chemotherapy. And they're already coming in for their chemotherapy, so it's not that much additionally difficult. The infusion-related reactions are really important to discuss with patients and with nurses. The way I instruct our nurses is any kind of a reaction, a rash or some wheezing or almost just not feeling right, we stop the day one infusion, and we almost never pick it up. We almost always just say, you know, ready to go home for today, and we'll see you back tomorrow. We give that second day dose, and that is, you know, almost always then goes smoothly. And so we're able to keep the infusion related reactions to grade one. I don't try to push it, and actually that goes quite well in my experience. But it is something to talk about. I've had on the trial, despite all that discussion, I had a patient say, I don't want to do this anymore. And the patient really lost out on the benefit, unfortunately, of amivantamab. So I think it's important to discuss. Now, there are several great presentations, Natasha Leal's presentation most specifically, but several pieces of data about sub-Q amivantamab. And as you know, a lot of the antibodies have been moving to a sub-Q formulation, and it really seemed to have a lot of benefits. Certainly, infusion-related reactions basically go to zero, and less time in the chair. The IV takes a lot of time, especially at the beginning. And there was the suggestion that the benefit was greater. So you're a win-win-win right there. And that I think, as that percolates through the Paloma trials and some of their other confirmatory trials, really could change the discussion of how we use amivantamab and bring it up. I do think that when you're using amivantamab with lazertinib, or now in the U.S. when it's done with osimertinib, the rash and diarrhea can be more problematic. And so you have more of the rashes like we used to see with cetuximab, where it's, you know, full face, full chest, and patients don't like that, understandably. So I do think it's not clear where an AMI-LAS combination would necessarily come in, but I do like the idea of AMI with chemotherapy in the second line setting.
Did you say that people use AMI and osimertinib?
Yeah, so without data, but so in the trials we've used lazertinib with amivantamab, but lazertinib is not available in the United States. So if you want to take that approach, and several people have, you use osimertinib with amivantamab, and this is, you know, somewhat following the concept is somewhat similar to some earlier things that we did, like afatinib and cetuximab. And Jonathan Rees at UC Davis has used osimertinib. I've actually just completed a similar type of investigator-initiated trial with osimertinib, necitumumab, and trastuzumab, actually. So different ideas of multi-targeting on these receptors, but so I think there was some comfort in following that pathway, but I can't say it's been especially effective in my patients. Responses are there, but the duration of response is generally disappointing with that combination.
Let's talk though about again, the relapse situation as somebody who gets first-line osimertinib. This has been a subject of a lot of work over the years. People look at various markers, et cetera. Now we have amivantamab. So can you kind of talk about how you think through that scenario? Do you do liquid biopsy? Do you try to get tissue? How does that affect what you do? And how do you think through the decision?
I think that's a really important question in the EGFR world. I think circulating tumor DNA liquid biopsy is one of the great technological stories in lung cancer. It's effective, rapid turnaround and rapidly, you know, used by the community. You don't have to schedule the biopsy. You don't have to talk about those risks, and you get the schedule the patient to come back next week, and you'll have results in most cases. So I do use liquid biopsy, but it is always important to remember that a non-tissue biopsy, you're gonna miss the histologic transformation. So small cell lung cancer being the most important, there are also some squamous cell transformations. It is also true that if they do transform to small cell, our treatment options are not great in that situation, but we do feel that going to carboplatin and etoposide with or without a checkpoint inhibitor is the best approach. I have seen some interesting cases where they weren't the typical expected explosion of central disease that on biopsy ended up being small cell or at least high grade neuroendocrine. And not all of them have I switched. Some of them I've stayed with a targeted therapy if their course of disease was more consistent with EGFR, typical, you know, EGFR disease, then I have looked at other targeted therapy options for them. The other interesting place is, what if you get a mutation like a RET fusion? Some of the most scientifically interesting ones are these secondary and even tertiary mutations that can develop. I had this really interesting 35-year-old. She actually enrolled on the DORA trial, but then had a recurrence, and then restarted osimertinib, did well for a couple years. On further recurrence, biopsy showed a RET fusion, a typical RET fusion. And I initially, that story wasn't out there, and I thought, you know, is this a lab error? But the pathologist told me, no, it's definitely real. We confirmed it on FISH at that point, and went on to selpercatinib. This was a single patient IND trial, and she had a nice response for another year, then developed a resistance mutation to that. And then we went on a second generation RET inhibitor on another investigator, you know, single patient trial. She had another approximately 6 months. So there are these, you know, potential relatively good stories. On the other hand, this is now a 40-year-old woman, you know, with a shortened survival, and 6 months of benefit doesn't sound so good. So I do think there are challenges when we think about large scale. Are we going to do this with every patient that comes through in a second mutation? I just saw this fascinating one, an ALK fusion patient, and on recurrence had both an EGFR mutation and a KRAS mutation. So these cancers are complicated, wily, and tough to stay ahead of.
What did you treat the patient with?
So in that case, I tried to follow the variant allele frequency, and the EGFR mutation was much higher, so we added an osimertinib. And actually, I should say there was not a benefit. So we ended up going to chemotherapy, and now she's doing pretty well.
One thing that we brought out in the video there, because I asked John Haymock about it, I'm so fascinated with tarlatamab, and I can't wait to see how you guys are going to utilize it, but whether or not that would work in this small cell transformation. You know, we're talking about that in bladder too.
Yeah.
Do we know anything about, he told me that I think the DLL3 is still retained or something.
So, I thought that was a great part of the discussion. We were not part of the tarlatamab trials, but now I've now treated three people at standard of care.
Really?
And,
really?
And I don't know about response rate yet, but actually it was, the process was easier than I worried. There was one patient did have some CRS, cytokine release syndrome symptoms of tachycardia, actually to 170, a young person, but responded well to therapy, and we'll be waiting for dose eight, day eight, the second dose on day eight. I think tarlatamab is really, really interesting. There are some ongoing trials that looked at reduced or non-hospital monitoring. So I think that's likely going to be what happens, is that with follow-on studies, you can, you know, monitor for 6 to 8 hours on the first day, and then probably even shorter than that as we get more data. I think it's a particularly well-tolerated bispecific. And so that will ease the use of it dramatically, of course. The question in EGFR mutation patients, I think, is going to be really interesting. The data that I have seen is that the DLL3 rates are lower. One of the exciting things that I've been working on is this consortium across the University of California sites. So there's five University of California NCI Cancer Center designated sites. And so we have a consortium across these sites, and we're going to do a two-part study, kind of like a basket study, where we test tumors for DLL3 expression, and if positive, then go on tarlatamab. And Amgen has pledged support for that, and we're finishing that up. But one of the areas of significant interest in California, where we see a very high rate of EGFR mutation patients, is those transformed patients. And if they're high on DLL3, we'll look forward to treating them and hope to see a benefit. There are other situations, lower grade neuroendocrine tumors, where not so much is known about DLL3 expression. I think small cell of the prostate is another really interesting question. So, right. I mean, this, you know, there was in lung cancer, there's two great stories, or maybe three, we should say, from ASCO. And one of them was EGFR, small cell, also a great story. Tarlatamab, I think, is going to transform at least refractory disease and be moved up quickly. And then the Crown data was also very exciting. So a lot has happened.
I like the palliative care thing myself. I've always liked that stuff. So even that really made it even better. But you've already given three people tarlatamab. So how much CRS did you see in the three?
So only one had CRS, that one patient.
The other two had none?
Had none.
Wow. Yeah, because, you know, like in lymphoma, like mosunetuzumab, I hear that story. And they give them outpatient steroids. And then, of course, glofitamab, totally, or not, the other one's different. So is that what you're hearing from your colleagues and the research and the trials? I didn't realize that.
So, I don't yet have the clinical feel for the drug. I'm hoping to get that with more experience. But this is another interesting question. So one of the patients had pretty advanced liver metastases and liver dysfunction on that basis. Previously healthy, no underlying, actually diseases at all, but elderly, upper 70s. But bilirubin has climbed to 3 and in a little bit of encephalopathy. But there was a comfort with giving tarlatamab in what you might call borderline performance patients, that it just seems to be pretty well tolerated. CRS rate is not low, but it's mostly grade 1-2. And so that's the course that we've started.
So I want to get to exon 20 in a second, but I also want to ask about the issue of antibody drug conjugates, particularly in EGFR mutant. I see that you have a trial looking at data. I think it's dato and osimertinib. The other trial is looking at just dato in EGFR patients. Any thoughts about where ADCs are going to fit in patients with EGFR mutations?
So, ADCs are definitely here to stay in lung cancer. And I think, dato in the unselected population, particularly non-squamous, is likely to be approved. And I think it is a slightly more sober moment in our assessment of ADCs, that they're probably more chemo-like than not, and that there is some benefit, but it's not perhaps transformative, a little easier to give than docetaxel, but a different way to give chemotherapy. And so if we bring that to EGFR, I do think it's instructive. I think it's very likely that patritumab, the HER3 antibody drug conjugate, is going to be approved very soon. And I think it is not entirely a foregone conclusion that it's going to be better than platinum pemetrexed. But I do think it should be in our armamentarium. I think that that patients, it is one of the better tolerated ADCs, patritumab is, and it doesn't have the higher rates of pneumonitis or mucositis that some of the other drugs have had. I myself have not seen any ocular toxicities. So I think that patritumab will be an important drug to use there. And as you said, the dato trials either alone or with continued osimertinib are really interesting. There have been several trials. I'm part of the ORCHARD trial, a multi-arm phase 2 trial that looked at a patient's strictly second line after osimertinib. And there's definitely activity. The single agent TROP2 ADCs have had response rates that are better than the non-AGA patients, the non-mutation-driven patients. Instead of 30%, let's say they're about 40% response rates. Doesn't necessarily seem that we have to select patients by the target of the ADC. I think, you know, probably the biggest theoretical question is what is going on here if you don't need the target? And that question is across multiple tumors. Is there some much less specific activity that we're seeing here? That one of the interesting thoughts that I've been thinking is the antibody just, you know, like a pegylated chemotherapy? Is it keeping it around longer? And perhaps is it staying in the tumor microenvironment, just like an albumin-bound chemotherapy, perhaps? And to some extent, the patients don't necessarily care what the mechanism is, as long as it's working. But I do think it's interesting, particularly if we think, well, can you sequence from one ADC target to another ADC target, or from one toxin to another toxin? But those questions are really outstanding. We don't have them yet. The answers yet. One of another ADC that I've been working with, Talisotuzumab vedotin, mm-hmm. is a MET ADC.
Right.
I do think it's functioned differently than some of the deruxtecan ADCs, where our combination with OC, first of all, we saw very little activity without OC, and these were patients progressing on OC. And then when we gave them the combination of Talisov with OC, very promising response rate of about 50%. So I think that, you know, I would love to study that further in a larger trial, and perhaps even compare it to another ADC. They were MET overexpression patients. What was seen in the non-EGFR mutated patients was that the benefit correlated with MET overexpression. So if you had high MET overexpression versus intermediate, you had more benefit. In the EGFR mutated patient, there wasn't really a dramatic difference between intermediate and high. So another question I'd like to answer is, how low can you go? Could you go to a low MET overexpression patient? Even so, MET amplification is a common cause of resistance to osimertinib in about 20% of patients. If you look at MET overexpression, you've got about half the patients that fit in that category. Hmm. And that is where the phase 2 data is encouraging that there could be a role there for Talisov.
You were commenting on tolerability of patritumab and the lack of ocular issues. I'm curious about what your experience is with Dato. We're seeing something there about the ophthalmic issues, also mucositis.
Yeah, I think both are important. Mucositis is really quite common, and that's, I think, the most common challenge of Dato. ILD, interstitial lung disease, is also there, but not that common. But the mucositis is common. I really like the steroid mouth rinses, but sometimes we'll use other ones as well. There's thoughts about, you know, if you put ice chips in your mouth during the infusion, does that help? But I find that to be probably the most common, you know, patient noticed toxicity. The ocular tox is pretty rare. It's possible that it's a kind of a relatively nonspecific toxin effect, and that just using a saline eye drop may be helpful. You have to use it pretty frequently. The ophthalmologists recommend hourly, which I think is probably hard to keep up, but may help meaningfully. We've tried some other eye drops, like steroid eye drops or calcineurin inhibitor eye drops, without clear benefit. So I think my impression, while it's still under study, my impression is that saline eye drops and some dose delays for patients that get it. It's relatively new to the oncologist dealing with these eye toxicities. So it was a little bit of a learning curve up front. I've had one of the patients that I had on the trial on Dato The longest was on about a year and a half or 2 years, perhaps. And as time went on, it got worse and worse. And it also became clear that she'd had a kind of distant, sort of, let's say, low-grade history of rheumatoid arthritis, and that there was some combination of the two in that patient. So I guess one thing I'd say is if the toxicity really seems outsized, there may be something else going on.
It's funny, when you were just kind of talking, I was, you know, flashing on some of the comments we've heard in terms of, you know, tolerability there with the dato. But I wanted to finish out here talking about exon 20. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, in a simplified description of your vision of actually how it differs from the other activating mutations and where we are for therapy, particularly first-line therapy and metastatic disease?
So I remember a discussion with Alicia Sequist maybe 8 years ago or so, saying, you know, what are we going to do for these exon 20 patients? It seemed, you know, kind of dismal, and so that's been a great place to see some development in the metastatic setting with exon 20. I've been using chemotherapy and amivantamab, and I think it's pretty well tolerated and effective. There are some newer drugs, the TKIs, you know, as you know, mobocertinib lost its approval and I don't think was a particularly effective drug to begin with. But some of the newer drugs, we're doing a trial, Eddie Guerin's running a trial of furmonertinib versus chemotherapy. There's also zipalertinib and sunvozertinib, and they all look pretty good. I think it's hard to pick a winner among them right now. Some of them have tried a trial design against chemotherapy, and some have tried a trial design with chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone. And I think I'm looking forward to seeing those results. These drugs are probably, you know, in some ways more like, you know, afatinib, let's say, with, you know, a little more toxicity, a little bit more off, you know, off tumor, on target toxicity. But they look like they're going to be meaningful, and some of the, and some CNS activity has also been seen.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Goldman, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.